Hello and welcome. Most folks not living in a bubble are, or should be, aware that for the past 10 to 15 years, the U.S. economy has been subsisting on, well, bubbles. Specifically, stock and housing bubbles. Dean Baker, in his fine book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, chronicles the growth and collapse of both bubbles, and does so in a way that even those less versed in the financial world can understand. Dean is the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., a think tank established to promote democratic debate on the most important economic and social issues that affect people's lives. Most importantly, Dean Baker recognized both bubbles and predicted their collapse, something the mainstream media failed to capitalize on, instead making heroes out of the bubble's cheerleaders. Joining me on the phone is Dean Baker, who is the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Dean, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean, we spoke last, as I mentioned prior to this broadcast, in 2003, where we were discussing the stock market bubble. Now, your new book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, talks about not just the stock market bubble, but the housing bubble. Now, when we spoke in 2003, I guess it would be tough for anybody to foresee that the stock market bubble and the collapse of it actually created, according to your book, Plunder and Blunder, the housing bubble. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So the story that I tell in there is that the housing bubble begins to take off in the mid-90s, and it coincides with the stock bubble. It's sort of a simple story that when people are making a lot of money in the stock market, they wanted to spend more. We know that. We know consumption soared in the late 90s. Savings fell through the floor. And they wanted to spend more on all sorts of things, including housing. And at least in the short term, supply of housing is relatively fixed. You can't build a home tomorrow. You can in a couple of years, but you can't build one tomorrow. So it started to drive up house prices. And that created a situation where people would expect house prices to go up. So if you're looking at a home and it's $300,000, $400,000, you might think that's expensive. But if you have the expectation that it's going to sell for $100,000 more in 2 or 3 years, well, you might be willing to pay that. And that's exactly what happened, and that's how the bubble got started. And it got perpetuated by the collapse of the bubble, the stock bubble, because when the bubble burst, 2000 and 2002, it threw us into a recession, and the economy was had a very hard time recovering from that. And basically what happened was the Fed lowered interest rates to try and give the economy a boost, and that helped spur house prices even more. And in effect, what we had was a situation where the housing bubble lifted the economy up from the wreckage created by the collapse of the stock bubble.
Right, exactly. And of course, there were a lot of, I guess I can use the term villains because you used it in the book in regards to Alan Greenspan. We'll get to that later. But there were a lot of villains in this story, and I listed about 10 of them. And the first one you mentioned was that on page 72, where you said the expectation of higher house prices in the future means buyers will pay more today. This willingness in turn causes prices to rise. But there was also the fact that investors were wary of the stock market's volatility, as you said, that the Fed lowered the interest rates to the lowest they were in almost 50 years, that programs for renters were cut and for home ownership were supported, that former President Bush's American Dream Fund spread over to Fannie and Freddie and also to private foundations and charities, and of course the secondary market, which bought the mortgage from the banks, and the appraisers were in on it, the fees that banks made, the bond rating agencies not doing their job properly, and the creation of exotic financial instruments like CDSs.
Yeah, no, that's basically you had everyone in on this to some extent. I mean, Greenspan's villain number one in my story, because this was his job, as Federal Reserve Board chair, they had oversight. They had responsibility to prevent bubbles like this. It was sort of frustrating to me in this debate over financial reform. You had people talking about how we need a systemic risk regulator, and I sort of said, well, that's true, except we have a systemic risk regulator. It's called the Federal Reserve Board, and they didn't do their job. So our big problem was how do we, we can call someone anything we want. How do we get that person, that agency, to do what they're supposed to do? Because in this case, they didn't. Right. But, yeah, I mean, everyone was making lots of money as the bubble was going up. So you had banks making loans that they knew people wouldn't be able to pay off. They didn't care because they threw them, they sold them to the investment banks who then packaged them into mortgage-backed securities and sometimes more complex instruments and sold them all over the world, which they could do because the bond rating agencies came by and said, yeah, it's investment grade, even though I had not a clue what it was.
Right.
So you had everyone making money all along the way, and the people who should have been clamping down on it, you know, just said, oh, everything's fine.
Right, exactly. Now, I just want to make a point that I did go through that list rather quickly, and I did that on purpose because it's not my job, it's not your job to teach people everything. They need to get the book and read it and decide for themselves. I pulled those 10 bullet points out from reading it and taking many notes, but I think I did forget to mention one entity, so it's probably 11, the media. Right, Dean?
The media was cheerleading here. They invariably would turn to the people who, you know, had a stake in promoting the housing market, the housing bubble, and oftentimes they were the only source. My favorite joke about this, unfortunately, it's not a joke, it's true, but David Lira, the chief economist for the National Association of Realtors and the author of the book Why the Housing Boom Will Not Bust and How You Could Profit from It.
Right.
He was the leading source on the housing market and in the media, and in many articles he was the only source. And Washington Post, I'll pick it on particular, every time they'd have a piece on the new housing numbers, they'd go to David Lira. And there's nothing wrong, you know, he knows he's an expert on the housing market, nothing wrong with talking to him. But the point is, he works for the realtors, and it's kind of funny because after things fell apart, you know, he was laughing about this. He was going, I work for the realtors. What did you think? He's paid to present a perspective that's going to be supportive of the realtors. He's not paid to give you his best assessment of the housing market.
Why would the media look to him? And why were they cheerleading? That's what I want to know. Why were they cheerleading, and why weren't they doing their jobs?
Well, you know, it's a combination. I don't know what you attribute to incompetence, what you attribute to corruption. I mean, what I'll just say is that I really doubt there was any reporter anywhere in the country who got fired because all they did was talk to David Lira and print or report what he had said about the housing market.
Right.
So, you know, suppose they had called me. Well, I happen to be right, so I don't, maybe they would have been fired for talking to me. But let's imagine they only talked to me and I was wrong. I was out there talking about a housing bubble and they ran these stories, you know, Baker says there's a big housing bubble. Turned out I was wrong. You know, the housing market just kept going up and stabilized, and, you know, it's 20 years later. I think they'd have to answer to their editors, you know. But if you even suggest, and I've done this sometimes, you know, I don't have anyone I really dislike that I could think of who's reporting on this, but, you know, if you even suggest that they should be fired, people look at you like you're speaking utter nonsense. So, you know, we have this culture for people in these positions where if you talk to the recognized authorities and do what should be considered really bad reporting, you don't pay any price for it. So, you know, for the standpoint of a reporter at the Washington Post or, you know, Chicago Tribune, you know, I'm thinking major papers. I'm not
right.
Picking on someone at some small paper that, you know, is covering everything in the world. I'm thinking of the major papers where they actually do have someone who's assigned to report on housing. You just call David Lira and you say, here's what David Lira says. That's fine. You've done your job. You don't have to worry. You're not gonna get fired for that.
Right. Do you think it has something to do with the fact that most of these media institutions are publicly traded corporations and they have interlocking directorates?
Well, I think it's more kind of a culture. You've talked to responsible people. David Lira is a responsible person, and I'll never forget, this was after the bubble had collapsed. I was talking to a reporter who I know is a decent reporter in the scheme of things, not a stupid person, at one of the major newspapers. And
right.
I made some comment about Lira, and she said to me, do you think he's biased? And I almost didn't know what to say. You know, I didn't want to call her a stupid idiot.
Right.
But I go, you know, I just said he works for the realtors.
Right.
You know, it's, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have this idea of reporting like that should be, I'm not a reporter, obviously, but, you know, I sort of thought that was like reporting 101. You take people, you treat them respectfully, but you recognize that they generally have a point of view, they have an axe to grind, and certainly someone who works for a trade organization, you should expect that they're presenting the views of the trade organization. That's what they're paid to do.
Maybe you should have called her stupid, because are there no more Woodwards and Bernsteins in the world?
Not a lot. I mean, I do know some very good reporters. I could give you a list of them. Unfortunately, not a really long one, but
right.
You know, but there are a few. But they really are the exceptions these days.
And with the reporting of this housing bubble, there were no consequences. And as you say on page 57 so eloquently, as is standard practice in Washington policy circles, few experts suffered any serious consequences for failing to recognize the stock bubble or the risks it entailed. It was common to pretend as though the bubble had been widely recognized and its collapse unsurprising. The fact that most experts didn't recognize the bubble at all was politely ignored. Again, isn't that the media's job to really make sure that it's not ignored?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is coming up again because you might have caught recently there's been this big effort to talk about how public employees have these huge pensions and
sure.
There's these big gaps in their pension funds and what are we going to do? We're going to raise taxes on everyone. And, I won't go into a long debate about this, but their pensions, for the most part, aren't that generous. I'm sure we could find some that have ridiculous pensions. But the vast majority of public employees, you know, that they work a full career and they get a pension that might allow you a decent retirement. They're not especially generous in the vast majority of cases. But the reason they have a big gap is mostly that they took the economists' assumptions on stock returns. So you had economists back when you had the height of the bubble, and I remember this very well because I was arguing with these people and they were being all very dismissive of me. Dean, you don't know what you're talking about. And they were telling us that the stock market would give 10% returns year in, year out, that you could assume that as an average, that it would give 10% returns even from the bubble inflated peaks of 99 and 2000. They don't like to be reminded of that, but that's what they were telling them. So when you go to the pension fund managers in Ohio and New York and California, all the states that have huge shortfalls today, they listened to what the top experts were telling them. It was stupid because the top experts were either incompetent or dishonest. Take your pick.
Right.
But, you know, to tell them not to have done that would have meant going against, you know, these very prominent economists, that, you know, in the government, at Harvard, you know, all the leading institutions. That's going to be, you know, you're asking a lot of a pension fund manager at, you know, Illinois or Ohio to do that.
Right. And as you say on page 55, there are actually virtually no economists or analysts expecting the stock market crash and the resulting recession. The 50 most prominent blue chip forecasters couldn't see the recession coming the following year. The 31 eminent forecasters surveyed by the Fed of Philadelphia for its Livingston survey saw nothing but blue skies ahead. And there's no repercussions for these guys. They still have a job. Nobody's saying anything, right?
That's right. And again, you know, when I raise this, people just say, oh, you're just being contentious, this and that. And, you know, it's kind of like these people are generally pretty well paid and they should be doing something for their money. And when you really blow it in a real big way, that was, as I say, predictable. And I should point out, this was none of them. So it's not just, you know, taking an average and say, well, on average, they were wrong. No, none of them. Not one of, you know, the blue chip 50, not one of the, you know, 30 economists that the Fed had surveyed as it's part of its Livingstone survey, you know, so they were all completely missed the mark. And then afterwards, they go, oh, we all saw the bubble. That's
right.
Bullshit. You know,
right.
Maybe
exactly.
They did. I mean, maybe they did, but they sure didn't talk about it.
Right, and the media gave them a pass to say that.
Absolutely. You know, so it's, you know, they just basically rewrite history. Oh, yeah, we all knew this is this big problem, you know, that's going to come, and, you know, we just whatever.
Right, but the guy who saw it, the guy who warned about it, you, the guy who was right all these times, were you ignored by the media, or were you kind of put into a box where they kind of put you in there, let you say what you wanted to say, and kind of laughed at you?
I was largely ignored. I mean, you know, I do get more mention in the media today, I think in part from having been right, you know, on these issues, but you know, certainly back then I was ignored, and today, certainly even now, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, every time, you know, NPR wants to do a piece on the state of the economy, they're calling me up. I mean, every now and then I do get mentioned there, so I'm not going to say, like, you know, they don't ever mention me, but it's, you know, I think there's a lot of, let me put it this way, there are a lot of people who have a track record of being completely wrong who are mentioned more often.
That's the rule instead of the exception. We're talking about all this stuff, but we're kind of not paying attention to the real-world effects of these bubbles. Who was hurt? Are people still being hurt?
Well, you know, look, we're sitting here with 9.5% unemployment. That corresponds to 15 million people without jobs. You have over almost 9 million people working part-time, would like to work full-time. Millions more dropped out of the labor force. This is a disaster. You know, it really is a horrible, horrible situation for large numbers of people in the country. We're not set up to support people who are not working. I mean, you could argue whether this is good or bad. You contrast, say, the United States with a country like Germany or France. Well, those countries have relatively generous benefits for people who don't work. You know, it's by design. And we could say that's a bad thing. We want everyone to work. But the reality is they're not working, and we don't have a social safety net that really leaves them able to live decent lifestyles if they're not working, at least for a prolonged period of time. So this is a disaster for huge numbers of people. And the other part of the story, of course, is that we count on people are expected to save for their retirement, for their old age, and most people have not. And they're approaching retirement. The one place where they had middle-income people had some savings was in their home. And that's disappeared to a very large extent. So you're talking about tens of millions of, you know, working-age people raising families who, you know, can't find work or only part-time work. They're really suffering consequences. Many of these people are losing their homes because home prices have fallen. They're underwater in their mortgages. And then on top of that, you have this huge baby boom cohort that's right at the edge of retirement. Some already have retired. And they're going to be dependent on Social Security with basically nothing else. And these are, in many cases, very middle-income people at decent-paying jobs, even put money aside. But because the housing market collapsed, the housing market took away their home equity, the plunge in the stock market following with the recession that took away much of what they had in 401ks. So you have an awful lot of people who are retiring with almost nothing, who had put in, you know, 30, 40 years of work, you know, at decent paying jobs.
Right. And of course, all of these bubbles, I guess, could be tracked back to the Reagan administration. Isn't that right?
Well, we had a shift in the dynamic of the economy that I really date to the Reagan administration, that if you go back in the early post-war decades, the 50s, the 60s, into the 70s at least, you had this virtuous circle where wage growth would track productivity growth. So firms would get more productive year by year, get passed along in wage growth. They would in turn spend more money, buy more firms' products, which would then lead them to invest more, have more productivity growth, more wage growth, et cetera. That breaks down in the Reagan years. So due to what I would certainly say are conscious measures, we had very anti-union policies pursued under President Reagan. We had a dollar policy that caused a lot of manufacturing jobs to be lost to foreign competition. We had the high interest rate policy that was the Fed with Volcker, which, again, made the U.S. uncompetitive in many areas.
Right.
So we had a number of different policies that had the effect of weakening workers' bargaining power, and as a result of that, wages for most workers no longer kept pace with productivity growth. So that created an environment in which bubbles could grow because you didn't have money automatically being recycled into investment because they didn't see the demand growth, so they didn't necessarily expand their capacity, their productive capacity. Money was freed up to speculate, and that's, of course, what happened originally with the stock market in the 90s and then with the housing market in this decade, or I should say the last decade now.
Right, and what you call conscious policy changes, what you mentioned, these are the items that contributed to these bubbles, and you say that unless the Fed actually acts to prevent them, I guess bubbles are going to be a common feature of our economy.
Well, they certainly could be. You know, and again, it's one of these issues that, you know, when's the next bubble going to take place? Where is it going to take place? I wouldn't try to predict that, but I would sort of say, you know, you can know when you see it, and it was certainly possible to recognize the stock bubble, certainly by the mid-90s, 96, 97, because stock prices had become so out of line with fundamentals, with earnings. And in the case of the housing bubble, it was the same sort of story. It should have been possible to recognize it. But I wouldn't always say in advance you're going to know where a bubble's going to come from, what the timing is. I'd say that's probably not the case. And when we'll see another bubble, you know, it's hard to say. I certainly hope not for a long, long time. But the Fed has to understand it's their responsibility to prevent bubbles. And under Greenspan, it's fairly explicit. He thought bubbles were no big deal.
I want to go back to these conscious policy changes where the high interest rate policy and the high dollar policy, of course, as you explain in your fine book, the high dollar policy actually hurts your average blue-collar worker but helps the higher educated workers. I'm curious to know what you think, Dean. Who and why would have pushed these kinds of policies?
Well, the high dollar policy has the effect of making imports cheaper for people in the United States. So if the dollar buys, just to pick numbers kind of out of the air, suppose that it's 1 euro to a dollar. We could buy a dollar with 1 euro instead of $1.5 to a euro, which is where we were at about a year ago. Well, then everything that we buy from Europe is considerably cheaper because obviously everything in Europe is priced in euros. So imports become cheaper if the dollar is high. Now, that has some beneficial effects. It, on the one hand, helps to reduce inflation because here we have all these low-cost imports, pushes down domestic prices of competing goods. So if we can get cheese either from France or from the United States, and the cheese from France is very cheap, well, cheese from the United States is going to have to be cheap too if they're going to compete. So it pushes down inflation. It also, in effect, raises living standards to some extent. So, you know, if I've got, you know, I'm on a whatever income, I could buy more with being able to buy all these cheap imports. So it has its beneficial effects. But the downside is that if you're in an industry where you're directly competing, let's take the cheese farmer. Well, cheese farmers are obviously hurt from due to the fact that you could import very cheap cheese from Europe. And the biggest areas of competition are in manufactured goods, where because you get a high dollar, you could buy all these manufactured goods very cheaply from China, from Mexico, from other countries around the world, which hurts our manufacturing workers. So what happens is you have winners in this story, the people that aren't put in competition, and those tend to be the higher paid workers, doctors, lawyers. That's, again, by design, because we could make it so that they are competing, but for the most part, they're not. So they're benefited by basically getting cheaper goods from abroad, whereas, say, an auto worker, a steel worker, a textile worker, those people have to compete with very low-paid workers, and that's going to drive down their wages, and that's exactly what's happened.
Right, and two of the big players in this whole housing bubble collapse drama were Paulson and Bernanke, and on page 113, you talk about how they declined to bail out Lehman Brothers, yet they decided to save AIG. Paulson refused, as you say on page 116, to give ground to the objections being raised to the bailout bill, where it would have allowed hundreds of thousands of American families facing foreclosure to stay in their homes. And of course, he also refused to allow serious restrictions on executive compensation. How did Paulson and Bernanke, or did Paulson and Bernanke, were they some kind of duo where they made the, it seems like they made up their minds about what was going to happen without consulting anyone else, except for, of course, perhaps the 13 bankers?
Yeah, I mean, this the bailout, the TARP, was a real scam. The financial system is hugely stressed, just to be clear. There's no doubt about that. But how you dealt with that, what you did, what price you made the banks pay, did you allow them to go bankrupt and then just keep the system going? There were all sorts of other options, but they didn't want to discuss that. So they said, here's what we're going to do. We're basically going to get Congress to give us a $700 billion blank check. And
right.
That's pretty much what they did. And they rushed it through. They said, there's no time to, you know, talk about what conditions could or should be placed on that. We got to do this right away. And one thing in particular that I focus on, not necessarily because it's the worst thing they did or maybe not the biggest thing, but it's the clearest thing. Bernanke testified before Congress that the commercial paper market was shutting down. And it's not even clear that was true, but let's for the moment say it's true. Okay. That's very important because commercial paper is what most major companies use to finance their operations. So even if you had a healthy company, you know, Boeing, Verizon, is, you know, as far as I know, they stayed healthy throughout this period, relatively profitable companies. They finance their operations through commercial paper, which means that when it comes time to pay their workers every month or it's time to pay their suppliers, they have to sell commercial paper. That's how they get the money to do it. They don't have it sitting in their bank. And
Okay. Ordinarily
that's not a problem. But Bernanke was saying the market's shutting down. So if that were really true, what that meant was that even healthy companies wouldn't be able to meet their payroll, they wouldn't be able to pay suppliers. This really was a story where the whole economic system would be shutting down, and a truly catastrophic story. Now, what I'll say, I didn't know this at the time, and I'm quite certain that the vast majority of members of Congress didn't know this at the time. Bernanke had the ability single-handedly to support the commercial paper market through the Fed, because the Fed had the authority to directly buy commercial paper from non-financial companies like Boeing and Verizon. So in other words, he didn't need the TARP. If he thought the commercial paper market was shutting down, he could just say, guess what, I'm going to start buying commercial paper. And in fact, that's exactly what he did the weekend after Congress voted for the TARP. So he created this false scare story, or it may have been a true scare story, but the point was he didn't need Congress to vote the TARP. All he had to do was say, he could have told members of Congress, it looks to me like the commercial paper market's shutting down, and because of that, I'm getting ready to set up a facility, and we're going to directly buy commercial paper from the companies.
Right. Term auction facility and term securities lending facility, those were those secret agreements, weren't they?
Well, these were all, this is interesting, these were among the lending facilities that the Federal Reserve created during the crisis, and again, this helped support the system. Now, at the time, they insisted they couldn't give out any information about who they were making the money available to, what the terms were, what collateral was put out. They were saying, no, we can't give that information out. Now, one of the things we got in the financial reform package that passed Congress a couple months ago, and of course President Obama signed it into law, is that information is supposed to be disclosed. So it's supposed to be put up on the Fed's website by December 1st.
Okay.
So, you know, again, I don't know. I'm assuming they will, you know, follow the law. And I have no idea whether, you know, everything's kosher or, you know, maybe we'll find some interesting things. I mean, it's going to be a massive amount of data. I personally am not going to have the time to be running through it. But I hope some people really do comb it over and see what's there.
December 1st of this year.
Yeah.
Okay. It is amazing that the bailout passed because, as you say on page 115, calls and emails to members of Congress were running more than 99% against the proposal, according to many members. By contrast, virtually the entire political establishment from both parties and the news media lined up behind the bill's immediate passage. And you say rarely has there been such a sharp divide between elite and public opinion on such an important measure.
Yeah, it really was a remarkable time because, you know, among, you know, sort of the educated elite here in Washington, I'm sure same story in New York, maybe even more so, you know, it was all like, oh, we absolutely have to do this, the whole world will collapse. And I always have fun with these people and go, oh, really? How? And they wouldn't have a clue. They just, you know, if you're an intelligent person, you're supposed to say that. But that was the standard story. And across the country, of course, people basically saw for what it was. Not that they have a sophisticated understanding of the economy. Most people have jobs, you know, so they're not reading in the details. But they understood the basic story. This was a case where the Wall Street boys had gotten themselves into really big trouble. Everything had blown up in their face. And they were running to the government and say, save us, save us. And naturally, people are saying, what? Why should you're the richest people in the country? Why on earth should we take our tax dollars and use them to save you in your time of need because you got yourself in horrible trouble? So the public basically understood what was going on, whereas, you know, the elites, the political elites, either believed or were telling this nonsense story, oh, the world's going to end if we don't give Goldman Sachs and Citigroup all our money. I mean, if you read through the papers, I think you'd find very few stories that raise serious questions about whether, A, the TARP was necessary, or, B, whether it was necessary in the form it took. And, you know, again, you just ask some basic questions. I mean, I raised this, it was kind of funny, because, you know, obviously I was listening to what these people are saying, and I'm certainly inclined to take it seriously when, you know, people are saying the economy's going to shut down. I at least want to hear what they have to say.
Right.
And it occurred to me that, well, the Fed presumably has some preparations, some plans in place that, let's say you had, you know, we had Lehman collapse, let's say the next day AIG, you know, we know it was about to go bankrupt, the government stepped in, but suppose they'd gone bankrupt, suppose Goldman had gone bankrupt and Morgan Stanley, you had this whole chain, would the Fed have been able to step in and maintain the system of payments, you know, so the concern, you know, as I was saying with the commercial paper market shutting down, that would have been a catastrophe. Would we have maintained the system of payments so that when we write a check against our account, someone will take it? When we go to the automatic teller machine, we can get the money out. Well, I was sort of inclined to think they would have a system of emergency system plan set up. And by chance, I met Bill Isaacs, who had been head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation back in the 80s.
Okay.
And he had told me that they had a plan like that set up back in the 80s because at that time, the banking system was under considerable strain because of the Latin American debt crisis. The major banks had made big loans to Latin American countries, which they weren't able to pay off. And he said that they were prepared to seize the major money center banks to maintain the system of payments in the event of a default by one of the big Latin American countries. So if Brazil or Mexico, one of the big countries, had defaulted, they were prepared. And it would have been really remarkable, and again, no one's asked this to my knowledge, it would have been really remarkable if Ben Bernanke and the Fed had not prepared a contingency plan for a set of major bank collapses, because this wasn't out of the blue. The financial markets had been seriously stressed since the summer of 07. You'd seen the collapse of Bear Stearns in March of 08. So it would have been unbelievably negligent if Bernanke hadn't taken steps as a precaution as to how he would deal with the situation where the chain of collapses continued. Because, to say, that, you know, the particular events, you know, who could have known Lehman would go under on this or that date and AIG would be next? I mean, you know, the exact chain of events, that certainly would have been unknowable. But the fact that the possibility that you could have a series of major banks collapse, that could not have been a surprise, given the stress that we knew was there.
Right. And on page 114, you say that Paulson and Bernanke changed course after having consistently minimized the extent of the problem. They both told congressional leaders that the economy was on the edge of collapse. So in one breath, or the day before, they're saying everything's fine, and the next day, what do you think would lead these two elites to do that?
Well, I think they wanted to give more money to the financial industry to, you know, keep them afloat.
Right, but why change their views in one overnight?
Well, I don't think it's a question of changing their views, it's changing what they were saying. So
right. Okay.
So what was going on was, prior to that point, they were hoping to sort of soothe financial markets, say everything's good, don't worry. And they realized that wasn't working. People were very worried.
Right.
And then they turned around and they said, okay, what we have to do is get money to these banks to keep them alive. And the way we're going to do that is by telling everyone that the world's about to end. And that's
right.
Exactly what they did.
Even though 99% of the calls coming into congressional representatives said, no, we're against that bailout plan, the people be damned, we're going to do what's best for the elites.
Yeah, and it was really, I'll never forget, I was on a NPR show the morning after the TARP, you know, was, of course, originally defeated in the House. The House voted it down.
Right.
And I was on a NPR show with another person. We were actually talking about a different issue. But in the break, the host of the show said, can you believe what Congress did? And, you know, just assumed that, you know, we would be in agreement. And I was on with other woman I'd never met before. But I said, well, actually, I'm glad they did that. I thought it was the right thing. He looked at me, he was just appalled. And then the woman who was on the show with me, who also, I think she was a lawyer, but point being, we both have advanced degrees, you know,
right,
from respectable places. And she said, yeah, I think it was a good thing, too. And he was absolutely floored. And, you know, he tried to raise the subsequent points with us, and it was clear he didn't know what he was talking about. But it was just so deeply held,
right,
that, you know, of course, you know, we want Congress to pass this, and it's really horrible that these know-nothings forced their representatives in Congress to vote it down.
It seems like, in the end, it was all just another giant redistribution of income.
Well, that's exactly right, because basically what happened was these guys were taking real risky bets, and during, you know, the good times, you know, 03, 04, 05, 06, they were paying off for them, so they were stuffing their pockets. Well, suddenly things turned the other way. And what's supposed to happen, you believe in a market economy, you take a bet, and, you know, it goes against you, well, you're out of luck. But rather than being out of luck, they ran to the government and said, oh, you got to give us money, you got to save us. And that's exactly what happened. So, I mean, you look at these banks, I don't think anyone can really dispute this. Goldman Sachs, out of business. Morgan Stanley, out of business. Bank of America, out of business. Citigroup, out of business, you know, and no doubt many, many others. But these banks would have folded. Their CEOs would be looking for another job. Their shareholders, you know, they'd get probably zero. You know, the bondholders would take haircuts. That's what would have happened had we let the market run its course. Instead, you know, the Fed steps in, the Congress steps in with the TARP, and they patch things up and making record profits. Bonuses are as high as they ever were, and they're just fine. We have 15 million people out of work, but the folks on Wall Street who were responsible for this disaster, they're just fine, thank you.
The elites. Yeah, and as you say on page 123, no economic theory shows that the economy suffers more harm from asset prices pushed too low by irrational market sentiments than from asset prices pushed too high by those same sentiments. It's just that there are two rules in this country, and they live by, the elite live by one set of rules, and the rest of us live by another.
Yeah, and, you know, that's very much the story. They're basically running things for their benefit, and they basically get away with making it up as they go along. So, you know, ordinarily they're saying, yeah, we want the government out. This is why I always argue with a lot of my friends. I call them free market ideologues. I go, no, they're not free market ideologues. Free market ideologues, when Goldman's about to go under because they're bad bets, go, well, Goldman should go under because they made bad bets. That's right. Not what they were saying. They're saying, give us all the money you can.
And you have a lot of prescriptions for how to prevent another bubble in the future. But after knowing what you know, do you think they would even care to institute those protections? Do you think they even care about what we think of them? It seems like they don't care, because if 99% of the calls and the email could say, don't do the TARP, but they still do it, do they really care about it? Do they have to care about us?
Well, it reminds me of a bumper sticker back in the old days when AT&T had the monopoly in the phone industry, where it said, we don't care, we don't have to.
Good.
And, you know, I think to some extent that's true. You know, go organize. You know, go organize to get a representative in Congress defeated or a member of the Senate. It's really, really hard. They have things locked up. If you don't have millions of dollars to run a congressional race, you're not serious. If you don't have tens of millions to run a senatorial race, you're not serious. And you're not going to get that by going to people who are earning, you know, $30,000-$40,000 a year. You have to go to these fat cats that, you know, are the real money. And it's very hard to do if you're talking about fundamentally changing the system.
So you're not very optimistic about real changes that would benefit the common folk coming down.
Well, I'm not pessimistic. I mean, you know, we have more tools today than we ever did, primarily because of the Internet, you know, so we can get information out. It can be shared. We could reach people. It's just, you know, don't underestimate the seriousness of the problem. And as it stands, I mean, I think it'd be wrong to think that we're like on the edge of changing policy in a big way. But we have an advantage that we didn't have with the Internet, you know, and that's a huge thing. I mean, the fact that, you know, I could type something, or anyone, don't mean singing myself out, people could type something and, you know, have tens of thousands of people read it in an instant. You know, that wasn't possible, certainly for someone who didn't have a lot of money 20 years ago.
Right, till they pass that Internet kill switch. You are with, of course, and one of the co-founders of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which can be reached on the Internet, since we were talking about it, at www.cepr.net. And there's a wealth of information on there. Your book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, by Dean Baker, can be purchased from, and this is a new one, Powells.com. That's Powells. Powells.com. That's Powells Books. Dean, tell our listeners a little bit about Powells Books, because most of the time we say Amazon or go to this website.
Yeah, I'd encourage people to look at Powells Books, because Powells is an old bookstore in Portland, Oregon, big old bookstore that had, it's kind of, you know, your dream bookstore. Huge selection of books, very knowledgeable staff, people who worked there for years and years who really love books, you know, so it's kind of your ideal bookstore. And they adapted themselves to the Internet age by having a website where they ship all around the country. They aren't, you know, at the scale of Amazon, but they do have a very big selection of books. They do ship everywhere. So, and they're also union. The staff is unionized. So if you want to support a bookstore that, you know, I think has some pretty good principles, I'd encourage people to look at Paul's.
Okay, great. You predicted the stock bubble. You predicted the housing bubble. Of course, as you said earlier, we're not going to be able to predict the next bubble if and when it ever arrives. But what does the future hold for the United States with these policies in place, with our housing market in shambles, with the stock market as volatile as it is? What do you see happening in the next 5 to 10 years with the unemployment picture the way it is?
Well, I'm worried that we've accepted these high levels of unemployment. I mean, to my mind, we have kind of an otherworldly conversation here in Washington. You have all these people running around yelling about the budget deficit, and, you know, they tell these stories, well, if these deficits continue in, you know, 15 or 20 years, then we'll be in a bad situation. And you kind of want to shake them and go, you know, we're in a really bad situation right now.
Right.
But yet that's kind of like, oh, well, that will sort itself out. And it's, you know, it's this disconnect that the people who are making policy, obviously they have jobs, but the fact is most of their friends, their family members, they have jobs too. And they just can't relate to the idea that, no, you got a lot of people here. This is a real crisis. It's not just a, you know, a small blip. This is, you're talking about years where people are going to be either without work or irregular work. They aren't going to be able to maintain their house. They're going to have a difficult time, you know, just providing the necessities for their family. And, you know, they don't take that seriously. And we do have policies. It's not hard. I mean, this is what Keynes taught us back in the Great Depression 70 years ago. It's spend money. It's really not hard, you know. And, you know, people go, well, how could that work? And they go, I don't know anyone who won't work for money, you know. You know, we have unemployed people. You give them money, they work. You know, they were working 2 years ago. It wasn't their choice not to be working. But you get in these arguments where people are looking at you like, well, that really sounds like from Mars. I go, isn't that the way it works? Don't you work for money?
Right.
You know, but so that's the key. I mean, obviously you want to spend on useful things insofar as possible. But the point is we have to get people back to work. And that just isn't a priority here in Washington right now.
And because of those conscious policy decisions and changes, NAFTA and so on, we might never get the manufacturing base that we had back.
Well, you know, longer term, it's hard to say what the economy looks like. I mean, I'm a little more confident that we will, for the simple reason that we don't have anything else to sell. You know, because it's purely practical matter that at the moment, at least, developing countries are willing to, in effect, subsidize their exports to the United States by propping up the dollar against their currency, China's
right.
being the most obvious example, but other countries are doing it as well. So it's a conscious policy that they buy up lots of dollars to keep the dollar high against their currency, and then they can sell more to the United States. I don't think they're going to want to do that indefinitely, because basically what that means is they're giving us money for nothing. So I don't think they'll do that indefinitely. At some point, the dollar will fall. Hopefully, it will be a somewhat orderly process, and then we'll be able to manufacture goods here again, because it will make all our goods much more competitive. So I think over a long enough time, we probably will get back a manufacturing sector. But in the meantime, a lot of people are going unemployed, and even those who are working are getting much lower wages than would otherwise be the case.
What's the worst-case scenario, Dean?
Well, worst-case scenario is we could be sitting here with high unemployment for a long period of time. We could have something like the Great Depression again. You know, again, I shouldn't use that word, because I don't mean to say we're actually going to see 20% unemployment. But, you know, the unemployment rate today is 9.5. I expect it to go up the rest of this year. And if we don't have some more aggressive policy, it could stay there for years afterwards. So we could envision that we get 10% unemployment through 2011, 2012. And it may be many, many years till we get down back to where we were in 2007.
Dean Baker correctly predicted the stock bubble and the housing bubble from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean, it's always a pleasure. I want to have you back. If you have the time, I want to talk about your book, False Prophets.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Dean.